A nameless guy rides around Brooklyn on a bike. That might not sound like a riveting lead character of a new TV show, but critics are raving about this particular web production. New episodes are online today. The New Yorker calls it luxurious and twisty and humane, radiating new ideas about storytelling. NPR's Elizabeth Blair has more on the storyline that drives High Maintenance.
Lots of people in Brooklyn know this nameless guy on the bike. He's a pot dealer, so he's always referred to as just the guy.
I don't have any, but I can call my guy and get some.
Can you call your guy? My guy's been kind of unreliable lately.
You know, the week I just got here. Yep, right now.
The guy's phone chirps a lot.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Hold on 1 second. Hi, Isabel.
Some literature.
Hey, dude.
Thank you.
I'm not at home.
His customers are delightfully diverse. There's a bird watcher.
Oh, red-breasted nuthatch, 2 o'clock.
An anxious assistant who's buying weed for her boss.
I'm a little uncomfortable because this is my first time doing this, and I was expecting like a more professional experience.
There's something poignant about the guy's customers, whether it's the novelist with writer's block, the young man who's dating a homeless girl he met online, or the reclusive man who lives with his bedridden mother.
Do you want one pill or two?
The guy is genuinely cool with all of them. Well, the nice ones, anyway. He even tries to connect with the reclusive man who's obsessed with the actress Helen Hunt.
Have you seen this Helen Hunt thing where she's jumping out of a window and she's in high school and she's on crank?
Desperate Lives.
Yes.
1982, some of her best work. That's like the early...
Crazy, man.
It was really great.
But some of the guy's customers are jerks who try to stiff him.
I'm not going to do anything. Just give it back or I'm
going... what? You're gonna call the police?
High Maintenance is built around these transactions. Episodes are short vignettes, ranging from 6 to 15 minutes long. The pot dealer is played by Ben Sinclair, who also co-writes and edits the show with his wife, Katja Blickfeld. Somehow it's fitting that they can't remember exactly when they came up with the idea.
It's, you know, the exact eureka moment is yet to be remembered.
I have a vague recollection of being on a bike in a bike lane in South Williamsburg.
Sober.
Yeah, totally sober.
Blickfeld is a casting director who won an Emmy for her work on 30 Rock. Sinclair is an actor and film editor. They write every episode. The fact that we don't learn about the weed delivery man's personal life is by design.
We thought it would be interesting if you only knew the guy as much as his customers knew him.
Some of his customers are stoners. Others are rookies.
I'm sorry, I could only roll this one joint, ladies. So sorry. You know, you can go down to the West Village, you can get a pipe there, or, you know, in a pinch, you can just carve a pipe out of an apple or something like that.
Huh. An apple?
Yeah.
That's so clever. Did you think of it?
Oh, no, people do that. That's something people do. All right, you can Google it. I'll see you guys later. You have my phone number.
Even though weed is what ties the episodes together, High Maintenance is not a series about potheads.
We never start, this would be a cool situation for a weed delivery. We start from complex emotions that we are going through, and we try to capture the authenticity of how it feels to feel that way. And then we apply some weed to it.
Ben Sinclair and Katja Blickfeld have been putting out episodes of High Maintenance on Vimeo for a couple of years now. Vimeo is the preferred website of a lot of filmmakers because, unlike YouTube, the site is easy to navigate, and Blickfeld says the material feels curated.
It felt like if we put something up there, it wouldn't just get lost. It wouldn't get buried under, you know, millions of cat videos or whatever's on YouTube.
I love a cat video.
I mean,
don't get
who
me
doesn't?
Wrong.
Vimeo is returning the love. The company is now funding High Maintenance, making the series its first original production. Ben Sinclair says the buzz around the series is building.
When I walk around in the streets now, some people just who are doing my character's job will come up to me.
To let them know.
And be like, I'm doing.
It's true.
To see the nameless guy on a bike in Brooklyn, it'll cost viewers about $2 an episode. A small fee to get High Maintenance. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
David Tennant starred in a British TV series as a grizzled detective named Alec Hardy. He was investigating the death of a child in the English seaside town of Broadchurch. That was the name of the series. It ran here on BBC America.
The boat that was burned that has Danny's DNA in it was your brother's.
Yeah, it was just left just off the beach with the motor chained to it. I mean, anyone could have taken it. They just used bolt cutters.
Who knew it was there?
Well, everyone did. It wasn't a secret.
Your son Tom, did he know?
Yeah, why?
Did Danny?
I don't know.
Well, this fall, there is an American adaptation of Broadchurch on Fox. It's called Grace Point, the name of a fictional seaside town in California. And the detective in this show is named Emmett Carver.
The boat that was burned with Danny's DNA was your brother-in-law's?
It was left on shore. It was chained to a post. Anyone with bolt cutters could have...
Well, who knew it was there?
Owen, my sister. Anyone else who keeps a boat there.
Did Danny know?
I'm not sure.
Now, as you can hear, this is not what you'd call a loose adaptation of a British series. There are differences, but here's the most interesting similarity. The British detective, Alec Hardy...
The crime rate in this area is one of the lowest in the country. This is a terrible anomaly.
And the California detective, Emmett Carver...
The crime rate here is one of the lowest in the state. This is a terrible, uncharacteristic crime.
Both of them, the Scotsman and the American, are played by the same actor, David Tennant, who joins us from NPR West. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi, that was an interesting comparison there. I've never heard that done before, yeah.
Now, how is it, explain this, how when this show crossed the ocean and morphed into an American story, you managed to cross with it and morph into an American?
Well, clearly by losing the word anomaly. I hadn't realized that wasn't deemed suitable for an American audience. I don't
know why. Evidently, not on the vocabulary list of American television shows.
Yeah. I just felt like too unusual an opportunity to turn down. It's such a great story, and it was such an extraordinary sort of moment in the public consciousness when Broadchurch transmitted on the ITV network, and it just became such a thing. You know, it was that I thought, well, I'm not going to miss the opportunity to tell that story to a lot of people who haven't heard it yet, because it's a great one.
But nearly the rest of the American cast is American. And you are, well, to those who haven't seen you elsewhere, you're a very convincing American. But how did you try out for the part? Was it offered to you?
No, it was offered to me. It just sort of, I came along with the executive producers, I guess, from the British end, I was very happy to do so. It was an exciting challenge to try and recreate something, but with a new set of circumstances.
You can drop the Scottish accent now if you'd like to.
I will.
If you feel
soon.
More comfortable, whatever you'd like to do. apart from dealing just with dialect, are there other differences between a Scotsman and American that you find yourself?
Yes, they sort of emerge. I mean, I didn't set out to be self-consciously different about it. I think you can only ever do whatever the script supports. I think it would be self-indulgent to go, I'm going to make this character different by giving him a quirk of some kind. I don't think that serves the story particularly. But even very similar scenes with a different set of actors, a different set of circumstances, it starts to evolve as a different character. And the very fact of how you speak somehow influences who you are, the way you move, the way you think. It seeps into your being, and it's quite hard to really break that down entirely, but I'm certainly aware that they feel like very different characters in my head.
In the course of doing this, have there been shots when some American on set, the director I assume, would say, no, David, you're being too much of a Scotsman right now, you get more American?
I don't think there were.
Never.
You do your homework, hopefully, before you get there. And by the time you get on set, if you're doing a different accent, whatever it may be, whether it's American or even a different British dialect, which, you know, I've done several of them, then you kind of want to get that out of the way so that it's sort of in your bones by the time you're on set. The last thing you want to be fretting about in the midst of everything else is a particular vowel sound. You want to work on that and practice that so that that's just not something you're thinking about. You're just trying to do the scene to the best of your ability, I suppose.
And what you said was very interesting, that once you get the language down, once you get the dialect down, that sort of drags you into other ways of acting, like acting American.
Yeah, it does, I think, yeah. I almost don't want to deconstruct it too much because it's something of the instinctive, which is what you're always chasing. I'm always nervous of prodding instincts too much in case they fall apart.
This is your American TV debut?
I guess so, yeah.
Now, I suspect that at the mention of your name, David Tennant, our listeners were divided into two groups, the ones who said, who? and the ones who said, Doctor Who?
Ah, there you go, yes.
You played the Doctor.
I did.
Your father-in-law, Peter Davison, was a prior doctor on Doctor Who, and I've read that watching Doctor Who was what inspired you to want to become an actor.
It was. It certainly did, yeah. No, indeed, watching my now father-in-law as a young boy was a huge influence on me. It's very peculiar the way that particular part of my life has worked out. He happened to have a rather wonderful daughter, so there you go.
This is more than a passing relationship with a television show that you had.
I know. No, our life, all roads seem to come back to Doctor Who in our life. But no, it was a huge part of my growing up. I was a massive fan, and it certainly inspired me to get into acting and to be the guy that, one of those people that tells stories on the TV. That was a huge part of my childhood.
I've read that you were inspired by Doctor Who at the age of 3 or 4.
Yeah, I was 3 or 4. Yeah.
I've also read that your father was a Presbyterian minister.
Well, he still is. Still is. He's retired, but he still does the odd. The odd guest preaching spot here and there. Yeah.
Did you think of yourself as becoming just another performer who would, as he spoke from the pulpit, you would?
Oh, yes. Well, they're very similar. He would be the first to admit that. There's a huge element of performance in being a minister in the church. Absolutely. And he's often talked to me about how if life had been slightly different for him, and perhaps the circumstances of when and where he grew up had been slightly different, acting is something that might have tempted him, but his performing skills went in a slightly different direction.
Is there something liberating now about being on American television, where people watch Grace Point and say, you know, this guy, David Tennant, he's actually a Scot, as opposed to everyone saying, it's Doctor Who! You know, it's the Doctor doing something else.
Well, I mean, the thing is, Doctor Who is, it's a huge privilege to be involved in something that evokes such enthusiasm. But you're aware when you take it on that the first line of the obituary may have been written. You know, it has that kind of reach. It evokes that kind of level of attention. But it's been lovely to be involved in Broadchurch and now Grace Point and find that gets almost an equal amount of attention, and I feel like I might have reached a tipping point where I'm as known for something else as Doctor Who. Yeah.
Well, David Tennant, thank you very much for talking with us about your transformation and for keeping up that Scottish accent all this time.
I know, I've done quite well. I don't think I've fluctuated once.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Time now for the latest installment of our series, My Big Break, about triumphs, big and small. Karen Parsons played spoiled rich girl Hilary Banks on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. But before she was rubbing shoulders with Will Smith on the hit 90s sitcom, Karen Parsons was just another struggling actress in Hollywood, working as a hostess, taking acting classes, and going on lots of auditions.
The very first thing I got, which I can't call my big break because it was a horror film called Death Spa.
Death Spa. Welcome to the health club where you'll sweat blood.
It was a haunted gym.
It's the place for a killer workout.
And mind you, it was a big deal to me at the time, but it was also kind of, you know, like not a whole lot of people saw it. Thank goodness. When I got the audition for Fresh Prince the first time, I think it was called the Untitled Fresh Prince Project or something like that. I remember my first reactions being, oh God, it's a sitcom with a rapper. Like, what's that? You know? When I was first auditioning for Hillary, the character was written as a model type. So my first reaction to it was, oh, well, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to get this. I'm not a model type, you know. This is silly. And so I did what I could do, which was I kind of turned her into a little bit of a real brat.
Dad, I need $300. What dog did he steal that sweater from?
Yeah, she didn't turn out to be a model type at all. Maybe a wannabe.
I haven't been this happy since I bought my Giorgio Armani suit.
Once I got the part, I still went back to my hostessing job because I didn't know what was going to happen with that show. And I remember Will and a bunch of guys would come by and make fun of me outside the window, laugh at me. Will would say, what are you doing here? What is wrong with you? And I said, I don't know what's going to happen. So I stuck with my job, you know, keep your day job for a while. And then, of course, we got picked up. And that definitely changed everything. My favorite scene was when they found out that Hillary dropped out of college. Will finds out, and he ends up blackmailing me.
Did you memorize that little list of things I gave you to do at dinner tonight?
Yes.
Well, just to be on the safe side, let's have a little pop quiz. Anytime anyone says Hillary, what do?
I bark like a dog.
The dinner table scene was hilarious and really fun.
Hillary! 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 Hillary!
Stop
Hillary!
Stop it! I can't take it anymore! I dropped out of school there!
It was fun to play that girl. It was fun to just be so self-absorbed that you say just ridiculous things. That was definitely my big break. That was a life-changing moment for me, and I believe for all of us on the show. I definitely wouldn't be who I am now if I hadn't had the experience of playing Hillary Banks. I sometimes talk in Hillary's voice, but not on purpose. Often I meet people at the store or on some place in the street, and they say, "You know who you look like?" And then once I speak, they say, "Oh, it's you! I knew it because of your voice!" I'm always like, no, you didn't. It wasn't my voice. I don't talk like that.
Actress Karen Parsons. Today she runs an organization called Sweet Blackberry, producing short films about unsung heroes in black history. You don't have to be the star of a 90s sitcom to have a big break. Email us your story at mybigbreak@npr.org. Sir Roger Moore has been the Saint, one of the Persuaders, and, of course, 007, but he calls himself One Lucky Bastard. That's the title of his memoir about a life spent working and laughing alongside the likes of Tony Curtis, Michael Caine, Frank Sinatra, Diana Dors, David Niven. I could go on, but let's let Sir Roger Moore do that himself. He joins us from the studios of Riviera Radio in Monaco. Sir Roger, thanks so much for being with us.
Not at all. It's very nice to talk to you.
Lana Turner taught you how to kiss?
Yes, she taught me how to kiss with a lot of passion, but without too much pressure. That happened because we were making a film called Diane, the story of Diane de Poitiers, who was the sometime mistress of François Prime of France. And so she takes the young Prince Henri in hand. That was me, and Lana Turner was Diane. And when the king dies, I approach her, turn her gently towards me, and I say, "You made me a prince, now make me a king." And I dived at her beautiful lips, and she choked and coughed and came up for air and said, "Roger, Roger." I said, "What have I done? What have I done wrong?" She said, "Well, darling, when a lady gets over 35, she has to watch the neck. So if you could kiss me with equal passion, but a lot less pressure, I'd be much happier." So I learned to kiss passionately without too much pressure.
A life's lesson, I'm sure. Going through this book, the constellation of names. So let me try and ask a theoretical question. If you were having lunch with, let's say, some of your old pals, Richard Burton, Peter O'Toole, Richard Harris, and Peter Finch, who would leave the table last?
I think probably Burton. I've sat at the table with him, and we've had to move away together, and him being sort of fairly legless.
Fairly legless means that he...
He had consumed more than enough.
It's amazing how much good work they did, and yet did they remember much of it?
I really don't know sort of how much they remembered. I know that there is no better feeling in the world than waking up in the morning and knowing what you had for dinner last night and where you were. Yeah. They're the important things in life, having a good memory. And I think it's very sad when actors have worked with a few in the theatre, and it's rather painful for other actors when you stand there waiting for a line. It never comes, you see, this terrible faraway look on their face. And then they usually accuse you of giving the wrong line.
You have an impressive list in this memoir of actors who have died on stage.
It's terrible. You know, as I start off in the book and say that, you know, that my attitude about death is going into the next room, and it's a room the rest of us can't go into because we don't have the key. But when we do get the key, we'll go in there and we'll see one another again in some shape or form or whatever. It's not the end. This is my logic of life on life after death. The reason these thoughts came into my mind was that years and years ago I'd been offered a television play, and the script was absolutely appalling, so I declined. But one of the lines in the play that stayed with me was that, you know, death is going into the next room, and none of the rest of us can't go in there until we too get the key to that room. That is my comforting thought for myself. Whether I'm right or wrong, I don't know, and nobody can prove it otherwise.
I have to ask one James Bond question. Okay?
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm all right. Reaching for my Walther PPK.
Oh, well, all right, you are ready. Well, you say you think Daniel Craig is a terrific James Bond.
I do indeed.
Because he looks like he could actually kill someone, whereas you...
Yeah.
Well, I want you to finish that sentence.
Well, no, I look as though I squeeze them to death with love and lust.
And those enormously pliant and flexible lips that you developed thanks to Lana Turner.
Oh, yes, exactly. No, I look like a comedic lover. And Sean, in particular, and Daniel Craig now, they are killers. They look like killers. I wouldn't like to meet Daniel Craig on a dark night if I'd said anything bad about him.
Do James Bonds ever have a reunion, you and Sean Connery and Daniel Craig? I guess Timothy Dalton and George Lazenby would be the one to, you know, the hard get, I guess.
Actually, George, Timothy, and Pierce, we've been together, the four of us. But Sean really sort of not that enamored of being confused with James Bond all the time. Sean, a damn good actor. But he felt that he was only being remembered for Bond. I personally don't give a damn. I just want to be remembered as somebody who paid his debts.
Sir Roger, you've been a pleasure. We'll wait for your next memoir.
I hope I live long enough to write it. Thank you.
Sir Roger Moore, his new memoir, One Lucky Bastard, Tales from Tinseltown. Take care of yourself. So good to speak with you.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. You know what's coming now. I'm Scott Simon.